We went for lunch this past week to a place that I've been to many times, and that I don't think that I realized that you had never been to.
That's right.
And it's a little like Greasy Spoon in Hazeldean, which is near where I work. And it's called the Red Goose. And it has, I think, a significant and storied history in the like Edmonton chef scene or something.
Oh, really? How do you mean exactly?
Well, for a little while, there was a chef club meeting there, like every Sunday morning or something like that.
There is a chef club?
Yeah.
Harsh.
Yeah, like...
I feel so deliberately excluded.
Yeah, totally. I don't know. It was a long time ago, and I can't remember the timing of like when it was happening versus like when I knew and worked with you and when, you know.
Right.
Yeah, like I don't remember what the timing was. But I know that like...
But what decade are we talking about?
The 2010s.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. The 2010s. But yeah, for a while, like, and I was kind of excluded from it too. Like, I don't think I was really actually a part of it, but I went a couple times, like with
you just showed
some
up.
Other
you weren't invited
friends
and you're
or
like,
something. Yeah, I just started, crashed yeah. it. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
You guys are here? Cool. Can I sit down?
Yeah, kind of. Like, I wouldn't go on my own, but I'd be going and, or somebody else would be going and they'd be like, oh, you should come. You know, it wasn't exclusive at all.
Right.
And I'm sure every chef slash cook was welcome, and probably the more the merrier. But yeah, I do remember that Braden Kozak of like Three Boars and High Dough fame was like partially maybe organizing it or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I saw him there several times. Mm-hmm. And I went with Nate Box, I think, a couple of times.
Okay.
And maybe with some other cooks and chefs too. I don't exactly remember. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there used to be like sort of a industry meeting day there.
Cool.
Where everybody would go and hang out and get, you know, assorted or what's it called? Breakfast or eggs any style or whatever
yep.
that plate is called.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think of the Red Goose, Alan?
What?
I have more history about it, but I want to get your take on it first.
Yeah, I'd heard about it many times. It's often appears like when people are listing the great historic diners of Edmonton, like the ones that
right.
you know, feel like they've stood still in time for decades, the Red Goose always comes up. And yet the interior is excellent. It's yeah, like it's got wood paneling everywhere, comfy banquettes and all kinds of the paraphernalia stuck to the walls that you would expect at such a place. There's like rows of photographs of customers and yeah, all kinds of knickknacks. I was looking at it most of the time. They're right behind you where you were sitting. So I was staring at it. There was like a bunch of like figurines of Boeing airplanes and like models of Boeing airplanes and you know, sports memorabilia.
Oh, those aren't aging well.
Yeah. And super friendly service, very in, like earnest, enthusiastic service. And the food was good. I had a club, yeah. I had a club sandwich and coated French fries and
oh, right.
And it was very good. The funny thing is that as soon as we walked in, I saw two people that I knew.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It is a real industry haunt, I feel
two
like.
Two people who are not...
It's a neighborhood haunt, but it's also an industry
right,
haunt.
Two people who are not currently in the industry, but I worked with in industry about 17 years ago or something. But so that was funny.
Yeah, I'm often like a little bit surprised if I walk in there and I don't see anyone that I know, but
right.
yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's like very, yeah, it just like looks like it hasn't been updated in years and years. But I would say that like, you know, for a restaurant like that, like, you know, some of the like vinyl seat covers on the banquettes are like in a bit of disrepair and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, aside from those little things, like for how many like knickknacks and things are on the walls, it feels relatively like clean in there to right. me. It feels like it's well cared for and like, yep. you know, things aren't just like sitting there for 2 decades getting dusty or something like that. Like mm-hmm. it just, you know, it feels well cared for. It feels like, you know, the food I wouldn't say is like necessarily better than any other greasy spoon or maybe nothing to write home about, but it is very authentic to what it is.
Yep.
And it's owned by Korean people, so there are like a few Korean dishes on the menu and that hasn't changed. But like the real history, or like the notable history, is that like you know, from when I started going there, which was like probably in 2011, and I'm sure like long before then, mm-hmm. it was owned by this older Korean couple, and the gentleman was like the host and the front of house, and his wife, I assume, was doing most of the cooking. Mm-hmm. It was usually just the two of them in there whenever I went in. And he, first of all, he has this expression to greet people and say goodbye to them when they like enter and leave the restaurant. So when you walked into the restaurant, he would say, "Oh, happy day," like really right. loud.
Yeah.
And point you to a table. And then same thing when you were leaving, he'd be like, "Happy day," as you're like exiting the restaurant.
Didn't the guy who served us like, say that too? Am I crazy?
Yes, okay, yeah. He did. In the tradition of the like first owners. And I don't know if the new owners are relatives of the old owners or what the situation is, mm-hmm. but like they like handed off that tradition, you know, as a part of the atmosphere of the restaurant. And they didn't want when they handed off the ownership of the restaurant because the previous owners retired, you know, they wanted to make sure that it kept its like charm.
Right.
And that was definitely a big part of the charm, was like how, you know, like how happy and eager the service was and like, huh. you know, using that, "Oh, happy day" thing.
That's amazing.
You know, like,
that's so yeah. special and sweet.
And so they just like, yeah, they like transferred it over to the new owners, and people kept coming in and it kept happening, and they kept their, you know, kept their patrons for the most part, I think. And the quality of the food is like, I feel like pretty much exactly the same as it was. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's pretty amazing. Like, usually when you have really passionate owners like that and they're, you know, going to hand off or retire, like it's really hard to preserve those like little things. And new owners usually would be like, yeah, I mean, it's a part of the charm of the restaurant. We'll kind of want to like, you know, keep that going. But, you know, oftentimes if it isn't specifically their personality to do those things,
right.
then over time, I think that they would like tend to fall off. But either they just found like the perfect people to replace the previous owners, or the new owners are just as like dedicated to having that vibe. And it, yeah, I don't know. It's really great.
So I didn't know when we were settling the bill and he said that, "Happy day," I didn't know that was a thing. He just said it.
Right.
And, but it did not feel forced or perfunctory at all. It felt
no
like jubilant. I would say like,
yeah,
he exactly. was, he was happy while he was saying it. Huh, that's really cool. That's so sweet, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you look, like, I think there's like some art on the front, like art posted like at the front of the restaurant that says, "Oh, happy day," okay. on it and stuff. Maybe it says that somewhere on the menu too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't remember. Oh, and man, their menu clip art is so hilarious. It's like, I don't know. It's just like the worst goose clip art, but like the worst best goose clip art mm-hmm. you've ever seen. And then like, obviously just like tinted red.
Right.
Man, so good. And it's right near where I work, and I haven't been there very often since I started working there. I used to go quite often, but like even when I didn't work there. So I would drive across town to go there like once every couple of weeks for quite a while.
Right.
And, but since I've been working near it, I don't know if it's just like, you know, I can go there anytime, so I don't have to worry about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And we were trying to go to a restaurant that's even closer to your work, the Bauernschmaus, but in the,
that's right.
in the great tradition of German and Austrian owned, food services in Edmonton, they close, usually the last half of August. But our Artistic right. Bakery, which is a German family, they do the same thing. They just like close up shop for 2 or 3 weeks at the end of summer and see ya in September. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's ironic about that is I've never been to the Bauernschmaus and you had never been to the Red Goose, mm-hmm. but you have been to the Bauernschmaus, right?
Yeah, it's been a while, but yes, I've been.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess that'll be happening sometime in September.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll go to the Bauernschmaus. Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sedeby. I'm here with my co-host, Shale McDonald. Hello.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it. The show with hot wings and hotter questions. What's the... I don't know why that just came into my mind.
Hot ones?
Yeah.
Is that from Hot
yeah.
Ones?
Yeah. We have follow-up?
Do we have follow-up?
I'm going to drive the bus on
Get
this
us
one.
Out. Okay.
I didn't fully read it, but I did see that the Danish government reversed their decision outlawing the those bulldog Korean spicy noodle packs.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting because I just saw a TikTok yesterday with a Korean lady talking about that.
Oh, really?
How the Danish government had like taken them off the shelves or whatever.
Right.
So that's interesting. She was like, hey, no shade to Danish people. I don't want anyone to burn their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
But she did find it kind of funny.
I didn't have any other follow-up though. You?
No, I don't think I have any follow-up either. Although I will say that I'm excited. I mean, I'm sure you're not excited for this, but I'm excited that it's getting close to the time when you are going to be going back to Ernest's and taking over their lunch service, and then I'll be able to come and try some of the stuff there.
Just the appetizers, you know, right? You know this?
Okay.
Just the first course at lunch will be my class, and then the second, your principal plate will be from a different class, just so you know.
Okay, yeah, no, I did not know that, but... Oh, yeah, because you're the GM.
Yeah,
so,
that's
yeah,
right.
No, that
we're
makes
the cold
sense.
Kitchen, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, and I think my mom's excited, too, so we'll probably come for lunch one day.
Awesome.
You need reservations for lunch? Probably, right? Yeah.
I would recommend, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, we'll be making a lunch reservation. I'll let you know when it is.
Okay.
Good times. So, food, we like to talk about it. What are we going to talk about, Alan?
Today, we're going to talk about one of the single most influential cookbooks of the last 25 years. And it's the French Laundry Cookbook by Thomas Keller
yeah.
with Michael Rallman. And there's another author, Susie Heller. Thomas Keller, Susie Heller, and Michael Rallman.
Susie Heller,
yeah.
Michael Rallman. That's interesting. Do you know, did Roman write all the interstitial bits or I guess we don't know.
We don't really know. It's kind of like you understand that this is like Thomas Keller is not a professional writer. And so he's paired with like Roman was a professional,
right.
Even though people will, I think sometimes people will refer to Michael Roman as a chef now. But he was a professional, journalist and nonfiction writer, that was brought on to translate Thomas Keller's voice and ideas onto the page. So based on what we learn in other Rallman books like Soul of a Chef, I would say you're right that Rallman, I think, wrote... It's an interesting cookbook because there's a lot of writing that is not recipes. These little sections
yeah.
between... or pages between sections that talk a lot about Keller's philosophy and some like important techniques and equipment and things like that. Based on the part of the introduction that Susie Heller writes, I think that she did more of the recipe testing and making sure that the recipes that they were using in the restaurant were transferable to the home cooks and other and professional cooks that were going to use them from this book. I don't know how clean that or how clear that division of labor was, but that's my understanding.
Right. That makes sense. And so the interstitial bits are probably like a product of both, like, you know, Keller planning the book, deciding what, you know, content he wants to have in the book, and then him and Roman and maybe Susie Heller and maybe other people as well, you know, editing like the format and the order of how things would go into the book. Mm-hmm. And then Keller and Roman like kind of writing those bits together or something like right. that. It's just interesting because like when I read it, it feels like, I mean, I know, how do I put this without making it sound like totally asinine? When I'm reading it, it feels like Thomas Keller's voice
yeah.
to me.
Yeah,
you know, totally. Like it feels like it's meant to be like perceived by the reader that in the, you know, in the parts where, you know, they're talking about dishes or talking about Keller's philosophy and stuff, it like reads as if Thomas Keller is talking to you about these things or
Absolutely.
Has written to the reader about these things. So
yes.
it's not like Roman's writing it from a third person perspective
That's right.
or something
yeah.
like that.
That's
like,
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a credit to Michael Roman. To say. Do you know what I mean? That he,
yeah, I assume.
As the professional yeah. writer to be able to capture his voice. And I don't know. It'd be interesting to know, like, if it's, do you think he's just interviewing Keller and transcribing what he says? Like, I'm sure there's right. a lot. I'm sure it's a lot more nuanced than that. But
come to think of it, I wish. Now that I'm thinking about it, I bet some of this information is probably out there for research purposes, and probably should have done a better job of looking into that before we got into talking about this.
Well,
the specifics
no, I mean,
of this
it's
book,
pretty.
But.
You're right. There, especially in more of Roman's writing, like he basically wrote a book about the process of writing this book. In a way, that's the French Laundry section of Soul of a Chef is the time that Roman spent
right.
with him writing yeah, this book.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think that our breakdown of it's Keller's book, it's his ideas, his philosophy, his recipes, Susie Heller making sure those recipes make sense for this type of cookbook, and Roman helping with the writing of these really interesting sections between recipes. And then there's also the, and obviously like a photographer also is getting credit here. I can't remember Deborah Jones. But
man, what a great photographer.
Yeah. Like it's this book. I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but I would say there's a lot about this book that like not only influenced home cooks and professional chefs, but also the way that cookbooks were,
yeah.
the structure of the
Man,
book,
no kidding.
The yeah. you know, the wide white margins and the beautiful, beautiful photography.
Even the size and format of the book. Like I don't remember a lot of cookbooks, like having this sort of like, feels like, maybe kind of feels a little bit like Letterbox or something, mm-hmm. you know, like it's wide, it's like really wide pages, it's kind of like a really wide and not very tall
yes.
book compared to like everything else that's on your bookshelf. And like after this book, it seems like there's just like every cookbook is like shaped exactly the same way as this book,
almost to the like in terms of the size and format and the photography. This is not a slight. It's supposed to be a compliment. It could be a coffee table book. It could be a book
yeah,
on the coffee yeah. table that people just flip through because it's so beautiful. And you're right.
That's
I don't know.
Right.
It'd be interesting to look at, say, whatever, some of the books that won best, like the James Beard Best Cookbook or something like that, to look at those over the years and see if you can see that change in format happen, because this is exactly like basically the same size and heft as like the 11 Madison Park cookbooks. What else? The Alinea cookbook.
There's a bunch of Charlie Trotter's cookbooks that went to like this format. Like,
oh, is that right? Okay.
Soon after this book came out, like, you know, very similar photography and very similar like format to, how they're shaped. Mm-hmm. Although I think I have Trotter's raw book and I think that's more like a regular book shape, like a little bit taller than it is wide. But yeah, I think. Yeah, like a lot. And oh, think the Noma. Oh, the Alinea cookbook for sure
yes.
is shaped like almost exactly the same. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what the shape of the Noma book is like, but
I don't think it's the same like horizontal aspect, but okay. Yeah. So yeah, this book, this is a stupid thing to say given our listener base, but this is meant to be the book of like explaining the philosophy and dishes and recipes of the famous French Laundry restaurant in Napa. It was written in 1999, or published in 1999. One funny thing, I tried really hard to find this quote, but I couldn't. But I distinctly remember reading something written by Rollman later on, where at the James Beard Awards for Best Overall Cookbook in, I guess, in the year 2000 or maybe 1999, everybody thought this book would, they thought it was in the bag with this book because it had been so successful and influential, and someone else won it. But he didn't describe it this way, but he said everybody was shocked. And when I read it, it made me think of like when like Macklemore won Best Rap Album over Kendrick Lamar kind of thing. Like everyone was just like, what? Are you serious? yeah. So yeah, I believe I read Soul of a Chef before I ever used the actual French Laundry cookbook. I think I did too, actually.
Yeah.
I think that the first time I got to interact with this book was at Jack's Grill. So circa 2009 or 10. It right. was one of the books that was like in the kitchen. It was cool at Jack's in the office. There was a pretty sizable library of cookbooks that the original owner, chef owner, Peter Jackson, had accumulated and left at the restaurant even after he sold it. But then there was also a little shelf directly in the kitchen, that had a handful of the most used books. And this was certainly one of them.
Right.
Yeah. Do you remember what your first time seeing this book or?
Yeah, I think so. So my cooking career started in earnest in like in Vancouver on Commercial Drive at Havana. I think at some point somebody, like I think I saw this book at some point while I was working at Havana, and I don't know who brought in a copy. I don't think we had like a copy there, but definitely like right after I left Havana, basically my like first real job after that was working at the Moraine Lake Lodge with my friend and chef mentor Steve Ewing, and this book was definitely available there. I think my first exposure to the book is probably I bought a copy. Mm-hmm. I think I may have bought a copy while I was working at Havana, and I think I might have bought a copy after I read Soul of a Chef. So one of the chefs that I worked under at Havana, and I've talked about him on the show before, his name is Nick Braun. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure he recommended reading Soul of a Chef to me. And then after I read Soul of a Chef and read about the French Laundry, then I think I just went and bought the French Laundry cookbook. So that's probably how that happened. I just had my own copy. Mm-hmm. And then I think I may have used it as like, because I for a while when I was working at Havana, I did like some specials and things like that. I did like dessert specials, and I think I may have used it to inspire some of the dessert specials that I ran there. I also used the Morrow cookbook to inspire some of the desserts that I ran there. But, but yeah, I think I was just sort of like using it on my own as reference. And then when I went to work at Moraine Lake Lodge, I think there was like a copy in the kitchen, and a bunch of the recipes that we used at Moraine Lake Lodge were inspired by the French Laundry cookbook, slightly altered or using like components mm-hmm. and sections and things like that. Right. And so we were using some of the recipes like directly out of the book. And the you know, the sort of like main impetus for that was that my friend and chef Steve had staged at the French Laundry.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Like a few years before Moraine Lake. Mm-hmm. And so he was, you know, really about it.
Cool.
And yeah, I learned a lot working there. That was my first real like fine dining trial by fire. You know, not that it worked exactly like a regular fine dining kitchen. It was a little complicated. It was difficult to get food there. It was, right. It's in the park. So it was like, there's a lot of weird complications, and staffing was like, you know, not what you would really usually need to do like, you know, real fine dining on the scale of something like the French Laundry.
Right.
But you know, the dishes were very good, and it was presented as a fine dining menu. And, I think that we were doing like really good food, given our constraints, when I was working there. And I definitely learned a lot, and a lot of that is due to influences from this book. And then, you know, I've just used this book so much for my own home cooking and things like that when I want to plan meals, or when I'm looking for inspiration to plan dinners and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if I'm having trouble coming up with things, it's just like, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of old now.
Yep.
And you know, definitely a lot of the ideas in it are like very well digested into like the core knowledge of the industry, and a lot of the things in it, a lot of the tips and tricks in it, and a lot of the recipes in it, and a lot of the food in it, you know, tend to feel a little bit like passé now, but it's still like a really good foundation, you know, like there's such good foundational knowledge in it. Mm-hmm. Like that, you know, when you go back and look at it, it's like inspiring, like on a base level, like as a starting point, you know.
I feel like I'd be interested to do a little bit more research on this, but I do think that this is like, famous chefs have made famous cookbooks forever, right? But when I think back to
Escoffier,
sure, yeah. But I mean, think about something like, when I'm thinking about some of the cookbooks by famous chefs who did operate, say, Michelin-starred restaurants, like I had one by Joël Robuchon and Michel Gérard and people like that. I don't think that any of those books that I've come across really pulled the curtain back on fine dining the way that this book did. So for instance, like a lot of the techniques described in the Joël Robuchon book that I had, and I say had because I got rid of it because it was so useless. most of the techniques described were,
take that, Robuchon,
were almost identical to what you might find in the tech book that we use in culinary school, which is cool. Like this, yeah, sure, that's classical technique. But the finesse items in fine dining and the kind of like way that you would bring a fine dining dish together were not really explained well.
Yeah.
And so I feel like,
yeah, like the difference between doing the restaurant or doing the recipe in like a workmanlike way or a more like careful artisan like way, it's not very well. The difference between those things is not very well interpreted by most books in the way that it is for this book, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And if I was trying to think about this and put my finger on, you know, how exactly was this influential? I think there's kind of different levels to it. The first one is like Keller's philosophy. I think that some of the descriptions of the, like how seriously he takes the craft, how much discipline it requires, how much respect he has for the ingredients and the people that he works with and the people he cooks for, the humility that he has. Like, you know, when he talks about things like the importance of making staff meal and the importance of, you know, executing proper technique, even when you're doing something that oftentimes entry-level cooks are doing, that's cooking for the staff instead of for the customers. He just had there's such a gravity to everything, and it was so detail oriented. And I think that just that attitude and that way of thinking about the job, was really influential. Like that's how people like in our generation started to talk about the work. And I think that was a change for like, yeah. So going from these highfalutin cooking philosophy ideas, there's also just like loads of really loads of techniques especially techniques of refinement that are just explained very well, not just in a recipe. They're not just like in the procedure of a recipe, but there will be a couple pages and it's like, okay, everybody knows how to blanch vegetables, right? Well, do you? Well, this is how we blanch vegetables at the French Laundry. Yeah. And we've talked about that. I think we've read from that page before on the show.
Totally.
What are other examples like? Oh, actually, when I was... Sorry, again, I don't want to get ahead of myself. Big pot blanching, how to use beurre monté. Like, that was a huge thing for me, because that's a perfect example, actually, of like a finesse thing in fine dining restaurants that doesn't really show up in conventional cookbooks or even like in the text that we use in culinary school. Like, yes, you learn how to like beurre monté. There may be like a recipe or procedure for it. But like how important that is in making those beautiful, perfectly glossy buttered vegetables, like, and whatever, like finishing steak with it and stuff like that. I had never seen it in a cookbook before. Little like details, there'll be little kind of text boxes beside a recipe that just give you some small finesse technique, like how to dry out the skin on a piece of fish so that it crisps better. And so like where you're kind of using the blade of your knife and pressing down on the skin and scraping it and kind of squeegeeing the excess moisture and stuff out of it. Loads of stuff like that where it's, instead of giving you 100 recipes that have that in the procedure, they take the time, he takes the time to stop,
separate
and say,
listen,
like this is what we do and why we do it and how you can do it.
Yeah, whereas I feel like in the old style recipes and in the old style cookbook, like they might make mention of that in the recipe. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, make sure the fish's skin is dry or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, but maybe not necessarily tell you all of the steps that they would go to. And then also like, you know, assume that, you know, you can't say everything in a recipe and that people will, you know, like if they, and that people will need to gain experience in like cooking these things in order to be able to do it properly. And that eventually they'll figure it out on their own or something like that, you know, whereas like, you know, Keller to like really give cooks a leg up in this book, like really does try to separate a lot of the unspoken or like undocumented things about how, what differentiates like really taking care
right
in the type of setting where you're serving this kind of food. And yeah, that seems like really original to me is like, you know, those little things that make the difference between how good the food is, like mm-hmm. those are the things that he wants to point out, because otherwise what's the point of writing this book,
right?
You know, kind of like you can give people recipes from the French Laundry, but if there's no hope of anyone recreating it, because you know the only real recipe for cooking food from the French Laundry is to go and cook there,
right?
Then, you know, and I think that must have partially been the inspiration for how much care got put into, you know, explaining technique in this book, mm-hmm. you know, that like if this book is going to be a document of any value, you know, then what we should be trying to do is like explain to people how we actually make the food with as much care as we do, mm-hmm. you know, and I think this book succeeds.
And actually what's cool about it is that getting those little bits of information, having them parsed out for you, explained really thoroughly, the whys and wherefores, it's almost like you're being trained by Thomas Keller. Like that's the tone, is like, yeah. These are the kinds of things that someone who is a really good instructor, trainer, chef, mentor, these are the things that they would be telling to you as kind of side notes and like, and reiterating them, explaining them in depth so that they know that, you know, if you're going to work for them, that you're going to do them every single time the same way. It's a very interesting, and excellent writing tone, that, yeah, you really feel like you're getting an education from this man.
Yeah.
And actually it's funny because my other favorite cookbook, another one of my very favorite cookbooks that we've talked about to no end, 11 Madison Park, the first cookbook, it doesn't do that. I know that there is some like, some writing done by Hume and Guadara, but it doesn't, you have to kind of look through all of the dishes and recipes and then pull these common elements out. So for instance, like we've talked to, kind of jokingly talked about how it was so common for all, most of the 11 Madison Park Place to start with some puree, right? But there's no section that says like, this is why we put purees on.
The importance
this
is, of purees. Well,
yeah. I know it's a dumb thing to say, but like, but if you, notice, you have to notice that it's on almost every plate. And then you go to the section where they have the 20 puree recipes and you read through all of them and you go, oh, okay. So they start sweating whatever they're making. They're going to sweat it in butter. They're going to add some liquid. They're going to add a cartouche. They're going to Vitamix it. They're going to pass it through a tamis. And so like, that's, seems obvious now, but like they could have a section that would be like, we love working with purees. It adds moisture and, you know, supple texture to the plate. It helps anchor items on the plate. It provides splash of color, background color. It helps us use up trim, like, and things like that. And this is the way process.
To get like a very distilled essence of a specific flavor of one particular food, or
and,
you know,
and for like, the process, like this is why we use a cartouche and this is why we pass it through a tamis. And I, again, like maybe that's not so interesting, but the book is not structured to give you that kind of insight. The book really is like, these are our dishes from these years, and these, this is every single recipe that we use to make that dish.
Yeah, I would say the same goes for the Alinea cookbook. Yes. Like there's a lot about, in the Alinea cookbook, there's a lot of stuff about like how they design dishes. Mm. There's a lot of stuff about like flavor pairing and brainstorming and like
the artistry.
Yeah, the artistry of how they put together the menu and stuff like that. And there are obviously like techniques and tips and tricks, but it's not structured in this, in the same way as the French Laundry cookbook, where, you know, like you'll just be going through and you'll be reading a section about the appetizers or whatever. And then, yeah, he'll just like break out and give you like two pages about why Hollandaise is amazing.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and can be used in so many different ways or whatever. It's just, it's a structure thing and it's an attitude thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like,
and a voice.
It really,
you hear his voice.
Like, you hear his voice and you really feel his like intent to give people the best tools possible to succeed at like trying to cook this kind of food. Mm-hmm.
So if we go from the philosophical ideas to these techniques, I was trying to think of like specific recipes that I use out of this book. And I would say that there's not as many as I thought. I was looking through the recipe index. One for sure is the torchon au foie gras. I feel like there's a couple things too, like where there was no other reference for us, because it wasn't either because it's an uncommon or luxury ingredient. Like, I don't think there's a recipe for torchon au foie gras in the culinary text, but even if there is, it would be I don't think it would be the same as the way that a modern restaurant would be handling it. But so I know that, and I've really only made it a handful of times in my whole life, but the torchon foie gras.
Me too.
Whenever we had that on the menu at Jack's, this is the recipe and the procedure that we'd be using. I used the, because I had a ratatouille kind of in quotation marks on the menu at Ernest, and we used the confit de Bialdi, which is just the fancy type of ratatouille. Yeah, cool. Use that recipe. It's interesting though. We used it as a starting point because you would get a kick out of reading that recipe, Shil, because for instance, it will call, like this in the French Laundry cookbook for confit de Bialdi, it'll call for 1 to 1.5 cups of sliced zucchini. So it's not a super precise formula. But we did start with that and then try and convert those ambiguous measurements to precise weighted measurements.
Which is tricky though, when you're assembling something from whole vegetables stuff, right? Like what's the size, what's the diameter of the cucumber, of the zucchini that you're using.
Yeah.
I can see why those vagaries are there.
Right. Yeah. And the only other ones, the herb oil recipes, which are more kind of just like procedures I've used many, many times. And the only other one that jumped out at me was the blini, the Yukon Gold potato blini. I know we've made
that's
that
so
one.
Funny that there's, yeah, we have quite a few in common.
But I didn't, there were not many others that I could pick out where I was like, oh yeah, like this recipe, yeah. These quantities are what right. I have used. Do you have more? You said that you used it.
I wouldn't say that I have a ton more. I have some different ones. So yeah, the Yukon Cold potato bellini I use quite often in a bunch of different circumstances. The Agnolotti.
Yes.
I've used several times. And the fresh pasta recipe from this book was like my go-to fresh pasta recipe for years. Even though it's very soft,
yeah,
generally in most circumstances. But
can you remind me? I know I used to use the fresh pasta recipe from this book, and if I remember right, it's mostly yolks. Is that right? There's like one whole egg, but then the remainder is just yolks, right?
I'll read it to you, Alan. 1 3/4 cups or 8 ounces of all-purpose flour. So it's AP flour too, which is kind of rare for pasta recipes. Mm-hmm. 6 large egg yolks, 1 large egg, 1.5 teaspoons of olive oil, 1 tablespoon of milk. So there's milk in here too. So yeah, it's like a very delicate, soft pasta recipe.
Yeah. One thing that I do like about that recipe is sometimes when you're making fresh pasta and you don't have excellent eggs, the color is a little bit paler than it really should be. And so using that ratio, like having that many egg yolks in like it helps make it really deeply yellow.
Yellow.
I liked that about the recipe and I have used it. But at some point I just said, we're just going to use a classic 3-2 flour to whole eggs. And it's my default now.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Like Ruhlmann's ratio recipe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another page that I had bookmarked in here was the big pot blanching page. Yeah. And then it's funny because like, I don't even remember, I remember now, but, when I was going through like one of the pages that I had bookmarked in here was a potato gnocchi recipe.
Oh, is that right?
And like, yeah. And I remember doing it now, but like, if you had asked me before I looked through here, I never would have thought that I got a potato gnocchi recipe out of this book, but yeah, I did. And I used it several times. I don't really remember. I think it's also very soft. I mean, obviously you can change the consistency of things with like how much you're mixing it and how much flour you're adding. You can add a little bit of extra flour or whatever, right. but I remember them being like very pillowy, but also like almost too soft to serve in most circumstances.
Have we ever talked about
mostly for cooking at home?
Have we talked about the technique of like you can make, a gnocchi dough that is so soft and moist that it is difficult to handle using traditional like rolling and shaping methods. Instead, piping it and partially freezing it and then cutting it into the pieces. Have we talked about that?
I don't know if we've talked about it on the show. It's definitely a technique that I have used.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah.
I just saw it for the first time in the last couple of years. And I thought that was nifty because you want a very delicate gnocchi, but yeah, if it makes it extremely difficult to work with the dough and to cook them and get them on
without incorporating too much flour or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I have the Bermonte page bookmarked, obviously, like you said, even though I don't really need it, but I guess I bookmarked it at some point. And then another recipe that I've used from here extensively is the lemon sabayon pine nut
tart, which we've talked about.
Which I've used on like several dessert menus at places that I've worked at and as canapes and lots of different circumstances. It's like a really great such a delicious but like fairly easy to execute recipe, and it has this like element of feeling very refined, but at the same time it's pretty simple preparation. So those are the big ones. So that's only like it's like 7 or 8 bookmarks that I have in this book, which is not that many. I would say that like probably there's twice as many or maybe more recipes out of the Bouchon cookbook that I've used.
Right.
So like in terms of its actual utility for, you know, recipes that I have used regularly, I would say Bouchon has like more in it, but you know, obviously this book is good for a different reason.
Right. Like the,
yeah.
Yeah. And it's about ideas and techniques, right? So like the, you mentioned the agnolotti, like I don't use the recipe for that, but I probably didn't even know that that was a pasta shape that existed before I read this book, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Me too. Like, I don't know for sure if I've used the agnolotti filling out of this book at all, but the way that the technique is described in this book and the reasoning for doing agnolotti that is given in this book and stuff is like, you know, all very sound. And that's, you know, what has, you know, what has made it so that a lot of times when I'm picking, you know, stuffed pastas to do, like I'll pick agnolotti because the way that it's done in this book, like allows you to do a lot of it pretty quickly and have like a really refined final product.
Yes. Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. And I hadn't,
it's great.
Like I hadn't been to Italy yet when I first read this book. And so it, but it was eye opening just from a production ease of production standpoint. So he didn't invent it, but he strongly suggested that you consider it as a pasta shape in your restaurant because you can make a lot more quickly than something like tortelloni or
ravioli.
Yeah.
Those are the big hits. So I think the crossover ones are, the foie gras torchon, the Bermonte,
the blini. So then do you,
and the big pot blanching.
Do you have, are there dishes that you've taken either to make at home or in a restaurant, like full dishes from this that?
Not aside from the lemon tart.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say, and even in most cases, the lemon tart, when I've made it, I've done something slightly different with the crust.
Mm-hmm.
I have made it with the pine nut crust as it is in the book, but most of the time when I'm doing it at a restaurant, I'll change the crust. So it'll either just be like a pat brisé or it'll be like another nut for pine
nuts. That doesn't cost $100 a kilo.
Pine nuts are so expensive. So, but yeah, aside from that, I haven't really, I don't think, tried to recreate any of the actual like French Laundry dishes. Mm. Have you done that?
Not really. I was trying to think like in terms of the influence the book has had. So we've talked about philosophy, techniques, specific recipes, but then I was trying to think if there were dishes that became very influential and you started to see ripped off. I think a lot of the most famous ones, like say the oysters and pearls or even coffee and donuts, I don't think I've really seen anyone steal those. I think that the cornet of salmon tartare, I have seen, and actually we've made, I think twice at Ernest's, we had one student who tried to basically do that exact, preparation as an amuse-bouche. And then we had an interesting twist on it that one of the chefs did for a special event where it was a parm tuile. And sorry, we're talking about the mini ice cream cone it's taken a bunch of different forms over the years at the French Laundry and per se. But I think in the book, it's like some kind of savory tuile shaped as a little mini ice cream cone. And then there's a salmon tartare as the little ice cream scoop on top. One chef at Nate did a Parmesan tuile with beef tartare in it.
Just
kind of taking the structure of that amuse-bouche and taking it in a different direction. But that was really fun. I can't think of any other... I guess so many of the dishes are so classic that you don't really rip them off. You just take the inspiration and... Do you know what I mean? Because it'll be like, there's like rack of lamb with a white bean cassoulet or something like that. And it's like, well, that's sounds great, but it's not, it's kind of timeless in a way. The combination of ingredients, but.
There are definitely other components that I've pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's this one picture in the front of the book. I think it's of, Yeah, it's like a truffle custard that's served in an eggshell. And there's like a little crisp potato with a single chive like running up. It's like two pieces of potato that have been sandwiched together and then like crisped so that they're basically translucent. And then there's a single piece of chive stuck in the middle of them. And I definitely remember trying to replicate that at some point just as like a technique thing.
Right.
I don't know if I did it specifically like for a canapé that I was working on at a place or something like that, but I definitely did this thing where I like, you know, used a lot of butter and sandwiched pieces of potato with herbs in the middle and then, you know, cook them between sheets of parchment to like keep them flat and try to like get them completely browned evenly and stuff like that. Yeah, I definitely like pulled from that. And I remember trying to do that technique at some point.
There's another potato preparation in there that it was the first time I had heard of it. Pomme Maxime.
Okay.
And it's funny cause it has such a classical sounding name. it's not in Larousse or any, resources like that. But you can look up the origins of it online, but that was, it's almost like a, it's like a thinner, crispier version of pavé kind of, like where the potatoes are more or less fully crisped. And only a layer or two thick, not stacked as high as a pavé, but, I've seen that on menus before, like that term, which I imagine, yeah, a lot of people first heard of from this book. But
yeah, I've also tried to make the Gruyere cheese gougères, but it was a long time ago, and I don't really remember much about the recipe. I'm just like flipping through and like just catching little bits of like memory and being like, oh yeah, I definitely tried that at some point or whatever.
One other,
it's interesting. I think like there's lots of things that I've taken inspiration from, but not really like tried to recreate whole cloth. Like there's some amazing pictures of this like tomato confit like canapé, and I've definitely done this like tomato confit with like multicolored tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Tried to do that in various circumstances for different components for different dishes and stuff like that.
One other, again, it's not, maybe it's more like a general technique, but the procedure for how he handles lobster, I think that was the first time I had seen that, where he kind of, I think he just pours boiling water over the lobster and it sits for a minute or something, and then it's shocked in ice, so that the idea is that the outermost flesh cooks enough that it kind of releases from the shell. You can take the still effectively raw meat out of the shell and then really carefully control the cooking temperature, as opposed to like, you know, fully cooking by boiling a whole lobster. And I think for the lobster tail recipe that's in the book, like they take they do that process and then they just like poach it in Bermonté basically until it's just barely cooked. So I've definitely, that's been the kind of default way to handle lobster when I've had it on menus.
Yeah, I think I've used a similar technique, but I don't think I actually got it from this book. I don't think I've really read the lobster section of this book or something. But I think maybe like, because when I've wanted to do lobsters in a lot of circumstances, I've wanted to try and control the cooking temperature, and so like I knew that there was probably a way to do it sous vide, and so that's probably mostly what I've done. And I think I probably got that information from
Serious Eats.
No,
there's a really extensive post on the ideal finishing temperature for lobster on by Kenji.
Oh, on Serious Eats. Yeah. I mean, maybe the most recent times that I've done it, I have used Serious Eats, but I think I used the Molecular Gastronomy cookbook for a lot of it. Yeah.
Modernist Cuisine.
Modernist Cuisine. Giant friggin' book that I probably never should have bought, because for the amount of use that I've actually gotten out of it. Like, so when you buy it, so it's like five giant volumes. It weighs like, I don't know, 30 pounds or something. but it comes with like a kitchen manual, basically, that is just like the times, temperatures, and techniques sort of like broken down into like a much more like useful volume. And after I got it and realized that it came with that kitchen manual, I used that kitchen manual all the time, and I barely opened the like actual books themselves. Like I think I like leafed through them a few times because I was interested, and there's a lot of cool photography in there. Mm-hmm. But like in terms of its usefulness, if I could have just bought the kitchen manual, right. that would be the way to go. But yeah, I don't think I've used Keller's Lobster Technique out of the French Laundry cookbook. It's interesting too, like I have had several copies of this book, but I think I currently only have one. I think at some point I had three.
Why?
Why? That's such a good question. I think at some point, I think I had bought my original copy, and then I had bought a copy of Bouchon. My copy of Bouchon got used like all the time in the kitchen. It was like getting smashed and I needed a new copy. And I think I like asked for a new copy of it for Christmas one time. And then I think it was probably my folks bought me like the set of the French Laundry and Bouchon came together for a while, yep. in a cardboard sleeve. Mm-hmm. And so they bought me that set. And so then I had a new copy of both.
Right.
And I don't think I ever opened the French Laundry from that for a long time because I had my old kind of dog-eared copy.
Right. Yep.
And then, yeah, I don't know where that copy went, but then I think, I don't know, maybe I don't recall like leaving too many cookbooks at restaurants, but you know, like I definitely did bring in some cookbooks to like Elm and things like that, and I felt like I lived there for a long time. Right. So it just like I, you know, maybe it just wound up staying there or something like that. I don't mm-hmm. know. Maybe it wound up staying at a restaurant that I was at for quite a while. And then I think I deliberately got rid of another copy, and I don't even remember where I got that copy from, but I think like a couple of years ago, probably when I was moving. So probably almost 5 years ago now, when I was moving from my last place into my current home, I probably got rid of a lot of cookbooks that I had duplicates of, and right. I probably either gave it to a friend or took it to a thrift store or something mm-hmm. like that. So yeah, currently I only have the one copy, and surprisingly, even though I feel like I haven't used it very much, when I pulled it out of the sleeve and opened it up, there were several bookmarks in it. So mm.
what?
So even though it's like my second go round with it, I without like really having much memory of it, I have definitely used this copy quite mm-hmm. a bit.
When I was going over the index to see which recipes specifically I had used, mm-hmm. I forgot that this book mentions diamond crystal kosher salt by name as the salt that they use.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Of course it does.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's
if that was like the origin yeah. of the obsession or whatever.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if, yeah, by the time I started at Jack's, that was the default salt. And so I don't mm-hmm. know if that was because of the French Laundry or if they just knew that it was the best some other way, but yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it would be, you know, like someone must have recommended it to Keller at some point. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't know. Or yeah, I wonder how far back you can trace the history of diamond crystal kosher salt mm-hmm. to fine dining. Mm-hmm. That would be like really interesting to find out.
I'm on it.
Yeah. Keller would be a good starting place. So maybe send Keller an email.
Sure. I'll
and just be like, hey, doing a history report. Mm-hmm.
I'll message him on X.
Maybe we can get him on the show. Yeah. Yeah.
What else?
Cool. What else? Yeah. So I think to me, like, and I've kind of already said this, but like, yeah, it's just like, you know, like I'm open to the page right now where it's talking about herb oils.
Yep.
Right. And there's just like all of the herb oils just like listed on one page, and then some like really interesting technical information about how they make them, mm-hmm. you know, and like, I don't think it's the first cookbook to like organize things in that way necessarily, but it just like does such a good job of making itself so useful. And there's something about the photography in this book where, I mean, it like has to do with the aesthetic of the way that the food was being served at the French Laundry when this book was published.
Yep.
But like the minimalism of the construction of the plates and the way that they're photographed just makes it very obvious like what the important things to focus on are, like in all the dishes. I don't know, like if you really look at the photos, like I don't know how real they are. You know, food photography is a little bit, you know, it's like two parts knowing how to make good food and one part kind of like smoke and mirrors and magic tricks and stuff like that. And I don't know how much of that is employed in the photography in this book, but like when you look at things, like they look so freshly plated and things like that. Like when you look at pictures, like I'm looking through sort of like the fish section right now. When you look at pictures of the way the fish is plated, the skin on the fish looks like it's at its like ultimate crispiness. Like it just came out of the pan and, you know, it's been dried off so that it's like not oily, and it's been, you know, plated in the exquisite way that they plate it at the French Laundry. But like you can see the textures in the, in the way that the photographs are taken. Like there seems to be a lot of care put into, like, if something is supposed to look crispy, it looks crispy. Like,
and like, if that sounds obvious to some people or like an asinine thing to say,
yeah,
it's, if you look through a lot of cookbooks that have followed, they don't actually, the plates don't actually look the way that they would in the restaurant. And the best example, maybe this has come up before, but 11 Madison Park, first cookbook, the plates are stunning. But if you look at some of the, say the pieces of meat, like a rack of lamb, the meat is a beautiful pink color. But if you look, it has not been seared or rendered at all. And so there's just like these gobs of white, raw, unrendered fat on a rack of lamb or a little pork chop or something like that. And it's funny because I probably looked at those pictures 100 times before I was able to take a step back and say, you know what? Like, there's no way that they serve rack of lamb like this. Like, surely, even if they're cooking it sous vide, they are searing and rendering the fat cap and stuff. But it's not in the photographs. And it's probably just because, they want it to look clean and precise, but it doesn't actually look like
need to be cooked the way that that it would be.
But most of,
like, I'm looking at this picture of like citrus marinated salmon on page 140 in this book, and like it, so there's like some orange segments that are on the bottom, and then there's like a little bit of what looks like probably like orange zest or orange dust around the plate, and then there's like a piece of salmon that I'm assuming was marinated in citrus, and then like a quenelle of caviar on top, and some like individually placed like little tiny chive rounds.
Yep.
But everything, like the salmon looks perfectly moist, and the orange segments look like they were just taken out of, you know, like a little bath of orange juice. Everything looks so just texturally the way that it's supposed to be, and so fresh and so moist, and like, yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't know if it's trickery, but it definitely gives you the feel of what to expect when the dish is like immediately plated and brought to your table, you know? Like,
yeah.
And you know, I know in food photography, oftentimes they use like glycerin and things to make things look like they're wet and things like that. And I don't know if there's that type of trickery that's used here. Like looking at this like lobster claw and the foie gras, like the top of the foie gras looks crispy. Like that only exists for like 5 minutes, you know, like at the most after you finish cooking this piece of foie gras. There's like a drip of oil that's like about to drip off the piece of foie gras. And like, yeah, it just, it feels like it captures the ephemerality of the perfection of what makes the preparation special in a way that you don't really see very often. Mm-hmm. You know, even in other like high end food, like cookbooks.
Yeah. And I think that it probably would be naive of us to think that they, you know, just took these snaps, like as they're making the dish as they normally would. Like there must be some industry tricks in there, but there is something about it. The plates look a lot more natural than they do, say, in the 11 Madison Park cookbook. Like where they're a little bit more in the setting. Like you can see the plate that it's on. It's not just like on a canvas kind of, you can see sometimes like utensils and table settings and everything like that. But yeah, the food looks very natural, like very appetizing and precise, but it looks natural and yeah.
Yeah. And really, like, I think, you know, what's important about that is it like makes it feel like you have a good reference for what it should be like, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like the salmon should be moist and the orange segments should not be like dry, or, you know, like everything needs to have this like freshness and the textures need to be correct. And you can look at the photographs and get a really solid idea of what the dish should look like and what it should eat like if you like pay enough attention to mm-hmm. it, you know.
There's a lot of great examples in just looking at the photographs and talking about it. Or you mentioned that maybe it looks a little bit dated, like some of the preparations seem a little bit dated. The plating style is like, this is at the height of the vertical plating trend.
Yeah, and
so a lot of the plates,
everything is just like a single stack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In the middle of the plate.
Almost like I would hate to be the server who has to run some of these plates. Like if you look at page 158.
Okay, 158. I'm doing it.
This is a dish called fish and chips. I actually can't remember what all the components are.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Actually, this is the exact photo that I was looking at when I was talking about like how you can see that the fish's skin is crispy.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like this, it's so perfect, this photo. But yeah, it's like two pieces of what looks like maybe snapper or like sea bass. Like, oh, it's red mullet. Yeah. And they're like stacked on top of each other. And it's like very, and they're both on top of, what is that? Is it, it's a scallop or a piece of,
it's called a pellet
potato or
a, it's called a sweet garlic pellet. Okay. But it's made of garlic and egg yolk and butter, but it's like a little bit of flour and cream. So it's kind of like a
dang.
It's like a
gnocchi Parisian
sort of, yeah. But yeah, so you have a green sauce, and then on top of that the pellet, and then on top of that one piece of fish, on top of that another piece of fish balanced. It looks another very precariously, and then on top of that a parsley salad, and on top of that some sweet crispy garlic chips. And so it's like,
yeah, it's ridiculous. It's like trying to get that to the table without it falling over is like it's a real challenging art in and all of its all of the,
what was that?
In and of itself, mm-hmm. in and of itself. And then if you flip the page and go to page 160, take a look at that beautiful piece of skate. Like, I don't even know how you could get skate to be that crispy on one side without overcooking it. Like, it looks so
It's by dredging it,
right? Oh yeah, it's dredged in a little bit of flour. Mm. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah, anyway, it's a real gem, this book. Yeah, Alan,
for sure.
Yeah, I would say, I wonder, you know, like for people that are cooking in fine dining now, I wonder how relevant it feels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because like for me, it just sort of was like at the right time. Like this book basically, like, you know, came out a few years before I started taking cooking seriously, and so it was like just like the perfect, you know, or like, you know, or for us like Food Network in the 90s or something. There's like something generational about that you know, not everybody who is in the industry now has access to or is even aware of. And right. I wonder if this book is one of those things, or if it, you know, is just in so many kitchens and, you know, it is like used by so many people in the industry if it still winds up being ubiquitous even for young chefs now? Or
yeah, that's a good question. I feel like on the one hand, they probably are not taking as much inspiration from this type of restaurant. If you look through, like, not that this is the be all and end all, but it's something that young chefs are probably interested in, but like the 50 best restaurants in the world list, and you look at the ones who have got the top spot before. The French Laundry, like, the food itself seems a lot, certainly more classic and in a way more quaint than what, because French Laundry was the top spot in 2003 and 2004. And you look at what's come since then, like with El Bulli and Noma and stuff, and it's way more off the wall.
Creative, avant-garde.
Yes, like, that's the word I'm looking for, probably, is avant-garde.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, I could see younger cooks not being as interested in this because it's not as crazy. But at the same time, like, for cooks in Edmonton, like, we've talked about this, like, you can read the Noma cookbook, but like, you're not going to be able to make most of the stuff in there because of access to ingredients and the practicalities of, you know, a restaurant service in Edmonton for Edmontonians. And so I can't see, you know, the Disfrutar cookbook, you know, being on a kitchen shelf in Edmonton because people have to consult it every day. Does that make sense? Like, whereas here, the techniques are much more useful and approachable for everyday cooking, whether it's in fine dining or casual.
I mean, I think my gut reaction to what you're saying is that, like, it doesn't matter if a cook is in Edmonton or not. If, like, I understand why you're saying that. Like, you know, what we have here for fine dining is, you know, a lot less, I would say, avant-garde and, you know, a lot less adventurous probably than in a lot of other big cities in other parts of the world and whatever. But, like, you know, like, I more mean, like, in the zeitgeist,
right.
You know, like, which I don't think is as limited to, you know, like, whether you're cooking in Edmonton or not. Like, at least for me, it wasn't. Like, you know, the things that I was cooking a lot of times during my career were, you know, potentially limited by that, by the audience that we have and the customer base that we have to feed here in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think that, you know, like, my actual cooking in a lot of cases was somewhat limited by that. Although I was lucky enough to cook at some of the more sort of avant-garde places that did exist in mm-hmm. Edmonton and in any real form. But, like, you know, when I, like, for instance, when I was working at the Blue Pear, which I would say is probably, you know, one of the more successful sort of
modernist
restaurants that had that, those types of food. Mm-hmm. Like, I was reading lots of stuff that we weren't doing there. Not that we wouldn't have or couldn't have necessarily, but, like, I was reading everything else too, you know, like, right. and taking inspiration from lots of different places. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, like, and so I wonder, like, you know, like, I as much as, like, for instance, well, and I guess this isn't a very good example because we did use a couple of components out of that book, but, like, you know, we used a lot of, I've used a lot of stuff out of the French Laundry cookbook in my career. I've used way less out of the Alinea cookbook mm-hmm. in my career, but I'm pretty aware of most of the preparations that are in there and how they're mm-hmm. made, you know? And so, like, I think that, you know, I'm sure for cooks who are working in, like, high-end fine dining, which, you know, to be fair, there aren't all that many of in Edmonton, you know, I'm sure that, you know, they are reading all of the new cutting-edge cookbooks and, like, the newest things that are coming out of restaurants that are in the top 10 in San Pellegrino and stuff like that. But I just wonder if they are still using this French Laundry cookbook because it just happens to be on the shelf in every restaurant that they right. work in, or, you know, it's just so much a part of the culture now that, like, recipes come out of it and they're so close to what's in the French Laundry cookbook that they just, like, have a, you know, that like the restaurant that they work in just has one on the shelf and that's where you go to get the recipe for the tart shell or whatever.
Let me try a different tact.
Okay.
This book is not as influential or consulted by young chefs because all of their ideas come from TikTok. All of their inspiration, ideas for new dishes come from social media.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Is that true? Or do they get their ideas from TikTok, but then like also go buy a cookbook? I wonder. I don't know.
I'm just thinking about my students.
I mean, they do still sell cookbooks.
Yeah, that's true. I'm just thinking about my students. And first of all, this is different than, you know, a chef who's actually working in a fine dining situation. These are the culinary students, though. Most of them have not heard of the French Laundry. The vast it'll come up even when like, for instance, in evening dining, when the students had to make every day, a different student would make an amuse-bouche. And when I'm telling them about it in the course orientation, I would show them a picture of the salmon coronet from the French Laundry. And I would say, does anybody recognize this? No one has ever recognized it. No student has ever recognized
it. Right.
I say, well, this is a very famous dish from the French Laundry. Anybody heard of that? And I would certainly less than, in any group, there's maybe one student who's heard of it.
Right. Yeah. So less than 10% probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. And like, you know, I think, well, you know, my story is a little bit different. I didn't go to culinary school until I was like older and, you know, sort of more like into my career, I guess. And so I was doing a lot of self-education.
Right.
And so maybe I'm a special case, but you know, I think that like, yeah, probably when I went to culinary school, especially in the apprenticeship program in Vancouver, I would be shocked if like 70% of people that were going to school with me hadn't heard of the French Laundry or seen the cookbook or something.
Right.
So yeah, so that's very interesting. Okay. One sort of like last tidbit that I kind of wanted to touch on, and this isn't necessarily really about the book. But like, do you have any thoughts on the longevity of the French Laundry?
The restaurant? Sorry, a restaurant?
As a restaurant.
Thoughts on its longevity. Well, one thought on its longevity is when I got to eat there, it was their 20-year anniversary.
Right.
So in 2014, I can't even remember, 2014.
Right.
So yeah, it was their 20 years since they had been open for 20 years.
Right. But Keller wasn't there for all of those 20 years. Is that right? Like Keller took that restaurant over, I think.
That's true. And actually, I don't know if that was the anniversary of the new, like the current iteration of the French Laundry, or if that was 20 years after the couple who actually started it. I'm not sure actually.
Right.
I know that they used that anniversary because people were clamoring to eat there. They were charging, I think it was $380 for a tasting menu. I remember that, with all the supplements. We've read that menu actually. Sorry, I forgot. With all the $50 supplements, like if you want to try the foie gras and stuff like that. But sorry, there was not foie gras on the menu because it was outlawed in California at the time. But I guess I don't know what you're driving at.
Well, okay. Yeah. Sorry. Maybe that wasn't that fair of a question. I just thought that if I left it open for you like that, that you might, you know, have some ideas of where to go with it. But I think like, to me, when I think about, and I'm actually like somewhat surprised about this as it relates to like Alinea as well. But like, I think when I think about these types of fine dining restaurants that are like on such a high level, they don't seem like the sustainability of them seems very tenuous. And, you know, like, and throughout my career, there have been lots of these types of high end restaurants that have, you know, been open for a long period of time and they seem successful, but at some point they say, okay, you know, we are calling it quits because, you know, we want to go out on a high note and it's just, you know, difficult to sustain this level of creativity and excellence. And so like, you know, the the big ones obviously are like El Bulli or Noma.
Yeah, Favican.
There are a couple others like in California and in Napa that have been like very popular and very well regarded, that, you know, wound up only being open for like 15 years and then shuttered because it's just like a very difficult thing to continue. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think it's interesting to think about, you know, I think that, you know, when I first, well, and then also like the attitude in like fine dining culture, I think, is that like you're always looking for the newest, coolest, best, hippest, most creative, you mm-hmm. know, like like for cooks that are going to find places to stage, they're always looking for like, you know, the hottest places where the newest ideas and the, you know, and everybody's talking about like the techniques that they're using, like those are the places where people want to go stage mm-hmm. or something like that. And like getting stagiaires is a very important piece of the puzzle in terms of being able to produce food on the level that it is produced at, like the French Laundry mm-hmm. or Per Se or, you know, other places like that. And doing that, like doing that on an ongoing basis is like an incredibly difficult management task, like before you even get into the level of attention to detail and precision and, you know, and care that's required to keep the food at a level where, you know, the restaurant doesn't just become like disregarded or something mm-hmm. like that. And I think that like in the current fine dining culture, it still seems to me like to some extent, I mean, the French Laundry is, you know, a little bit sort of like maybe left behind, but it still seems very relevant. Thomas Keller and the French Laundry, like it's showing up on the Bear.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So people still take it seriously. Mm-hmm. And that just, like, I think when I first learned about it and was first reading about it, it seemed like the kind of thing that, like, wow, this is, like, really amazing right now. But, you know, you look at the rest of the industry and you look at where things going and you're like, you know, but like, eventually all of these, like, styles of food, like, go out of fashion or,
right,
you know, and then people forget about them, you know? Like Favican or something like that, yep. You know, like it, like I'll probably never forget that Favican existed.
Right.
But like, you know, it's sort of like, I feel like there's, do people a disservice by calling them flash in the pans, which they are not,
right.
You know, they're extraordinary. They're like extraordinary gems of human effort and like amazing things that happen when they do happen and are good. But you know, like the culture moves so quickly and has a tendency to forget things so quickly that like I think that, you know, when I was reading about the French Laundry in my early career, I assumed that late in my career?
Yes.
We're kind of getting there. I assumed that late in my career, it would no longer be relevant and probably would no longer be open, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know? And I assumed that like, if I didn't eat at the French Laundry in like the early 2000s, that I would probably never have an opportunity.
I see it.
But apparently, you know, it's still open and it's still good. And they still have like amazing chefs that are going through there who care about food. And, mm-hmm. and like, that's kind of surprising to me. And is sort of a counterpoint to, I think, like the attitude that I have taken on this podcast sometimes, where it's like, well, you know, fine dining is great and all, like it's a real, you know, like it's like a really amazing treasure, but it's totally unsustainable. Like seemingly, right. In the case of places like the French Laundry, people have found a way to make it sustainable and give it some longevity. And I think, you know, part of the reason for that is because they can kind of charge whatever they want. Right. So, you know, yeah. like they can kind of charge for a meal whatever they need to justify being able to keep it open, mm-hmm. you know, as long as people are still interested and as long as the food is still good. You know, because it's famous and popular, they kind of have that on their side in terms of, and some other things too, you know, like, I mean, they're probably still not making money off the proceeds of the French Laundry cookbook so much, but I think that there are other things, that they probably, you know, they probably have other external sources of income because it's such a popular and famous restaurant. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's like an interesting counterpoint to the idea that like fine dining is not sustainable.
Right.
And I don't know. I guess like part of me finds that encouraging. And also I'm kind of like, huh, maybe I could still go and have a meal there sometime. Right. I don't know. Like there's probably other places that I would want to go, but I don't know. The French Laundry for me at this point, like it would sort of be like a bucket list thing or something. Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and are you surprised that it's still open and popular and good?
Well, no, I'm certainly not surprised that it's still open. Like it's because it is part of an empire now, like the Thomas Keller.
No, that's
empire,
true.
Because it's it's not just French Laundry. It's French Laundry and Per Se and Bouchon and then Bouchon Bakery, like the much more casual. And there's multiple locations of that, right? Like I think isn't there a Bouchon in Las Vegas and.
As
Napa and stuff.
And
so I think that Keller has done a pretty good job of it, kind of like, who would he be like Joël Robuchon kind of, where he still has loads of respect for quality and consistency, even with other chefs, mm-hmm. But he has built it into an empire.
Right. Or like Boulud.
Yeah, totally. And I don't know if that's the same. If you look at the other restaurants on the list that have had the top spot before, like to a certain extent, most of them have done something like that, but not necessarily with the number of locations. Like René Redzepi, like he certainly has an empire now. You know what I mean? Like between the books and the Kyoto dinners and stuff like that, like. But he doesn't have.
And they sell, like Noma sells retail goods online
exactly,
now and stuff like that. Yeah.
I think if I look at I actually have it open here. Like if I look at the list of restaurants that have had that top spot, the only ones that I know for certain are Closed or El Bulli and Noma. And the rest, as far as I know, are still around because it's French Laundry,
okay.
Fat Duck, the Roca Brothers one, Osteria Francescana, 11 Madison Park, Mirazur.
Is the Fat Duck still open? I thought it was closed.
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's still open. Let me check. It opens soon, Shale. It opens at 7 p.m. in Maidenhead. Or Bray.
All
Bray,
right, cool. Yeah.
And my friend Alexander the Guest had a video from there recently, actually, now that I'm thinking about it.
Oh, cool.
He's not my friend. That was just a joke.
Yeah, he's your, what do you call that, parasocial friend?
Yeah. I as far as I know, only two of the restaurants have closed. It certainly is a testament. And it has kind of become, like, it's an institution now, I guess. Has that, I guess, as you see in The Bear, like, plays a role in bringing up new generations of fine dining chefs. So that's really cool.
I'm curious to see like if there are still any standards, like old dishes on the current French Laundry menu.
The last time I checked, they don't actually publish the menus online anymore. Like they used to put the day's menu up. Last I looked, they weren't doing that.
No, they're doing it now.
Oh, is that right? Okay. I would be.
Yeah. I'm on thomaskeller.com/TFL/menu, and it says here daily menus. Two tasting menus are offered daily, and there's the chef's tasting menu and tasting of vegetables. Mm-hmm. And the chef's tasting menu, the first dish is oysters and pearls.
Yes.
So
I think that,
yeah,
because even at I ate at Per Se in 2012, and you got the salmon coronet you got the oysters and pearls, you got the coffee and donuts. I think that those are the hallmark, the signature dishes that will never go anywhere, but that leaves you loads of room to play still and do new things.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the rest of the stuff on here, the mac and cheese is on here. But yeah, everything else I think on this menu is not something that is in the French Laundry cookbook. Mm-hmm. So yeah, which is not surprising, but I just, you know, like I think that that's sort of the, another part of what I was getting at is that that's sort of the danger is that, like, you know, if you are a restaurant that is like renowned for certain dishes or something that like, that you wind up having to just sort of like have your food and your menu stagnate. But yeah, that doesn't appear to be the case here.
It's nice because the
is also encouraging.
The coronet and the coffee and donuts dish, like they're not even on the menu. You'll always get them, but it's like the informal amuse-bouche and a kind of surprise dessert or unlisted dessert.
Right.
But yeah, I think oysters and pearls is definitely the hallmark. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, maybe Alan, maybe one day I'll get to go.
Save up.
I have the website open right now. Should I look at the... Should I check the reservations?
Are they on OpenTable? I'm just
kidding. No, they use something different, apparently.
Like, I don't know. I imagine it used to be that, you know, they would open the reservations 1 month in advance and they would sell out in no time at all, but you'd have to call them and make the reservation.
Right.
I assume it's the same way. There's no way that it's just online booking, right?
Yeah, it looks like, there's only one day open for booking right now, and it's September 20th. So yeah, a month in advance you have to book. Mm. However, it looks like, hokey smokes. I'm assuming this includes the wine tasting as well, but it's $600 a person.
Can you assume that?
The reason why I'm assuming is that is because it said that the actual menu is $390.
Oh, okay.
So, So I'm assuming that this is the menu plus the wine tastings.
It's the menu plus the booking fee.
I hope not. This is interesting too. Like, oh no, this is probably what it is. It looks like on that evening they have a black truffle and caviar dinner.
Oh, so. I see.
I think that's why it's more expensive. I don't know if that's like a one-time thing or if they do that every Friday or something, but it looks like there's a table available. So, I mean, I'm not going to book it right now, but it looks like it maybe is not that difficult.
Interesting.
To get a table. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, so yeah. Okay. Right. There are several menus that you can... that you can pre-buy here when you book your table. And yeah, one of them is the black truffle and caviar dinner. And it's actually, I lied, it's not $600 a person, it's $1,200 a person.
Okay, got it.
That's pretty epic. The regular dinner menu with no additional add-ons is $390 a person. Mm. I'll have to wait until the Canadian dollar's really strong, Alan.
After November, maybe.
Hey, listeners. You can help support Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sedeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.